This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Lots of teenagers have fantasized about meeting their celebrity crush. But what would happen if that dream actually came true? In her new novel, Bring Me Back, Karen Booth explores this scenario through the eyes of a single mom named Claire Abbey. Claire spent her teenage years dreaming of a British rock icon, Christopher Penman. And her life is turned upside down when she lands an interview with him for Rolling Stone magazine. This fictional heartthrob is modeled on Booth's real-life infatuation with the band Duran Duran. There we go. Karen Booth's crush spurred her eventually to enter the music business for real. She ended up at Mammoth Records in Chapel Hill, and she draws on that experience to give readers backstage access to the lives of rock stars and the fans who adore them. Karen Booth joins us now on The State of Things to talk about her book, Bring Me Back. Hi, Karen. Thanks
Hi,
for being
Frank.
Here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about the book. I want to hear more about your infatuation with Duran Duran and your music career, but tell us what goes on in this book.
Well, essentially, it's a love story, because who wants to meet their crush and then not fall in love with them? I think the big thing for me was the idea of writing a modern fairy tale, but then trying to make it as realistic as possible, because then it's a real escape for the reader. So it's really about Claire falling in love, but also trying to make the compromises that make, you know, that new relationship in her life an okay part of everything else that's going on with her career. She has a teenage daughter. She has a very intense relationship with her dad. So basically a lot of moving parts and trying to make everything work so that she can have her happy ending.
And it is a lot about escape. I mean, there is it's a tough life to have to live through the real life. And then there's the fantasy life of your, you know, your heartthrob.
Right.
Then there he is.
Right.
He turns out to be an okay guy, because that's the other story you could tell.
Sure,
the guy who you always loved turns out to be not such a great guy.
Right. Well, I mean, and in the book, there are times when he, you know, he has a darker side. I think he's very prone to sort of being, I think, like a lot of musicians, being very self-focused, very internal with everything. And so there is a period in the book where he really retreats to that place and Claire has to basically wedge him out of it.
So you drew a lot of your inspiration from your teenage years. Duran Duran, huh?
Yes.
Now, I'm just going to say this. I will never forgive you for making me. But no. But that's your band. And
right.
So that was a time. And we've all had that. I mean, we've all had either identified with the band who we wanted to be because someone would be screaming for us.
Sure.
Or that band who you would wish would lavish attention on you.
Right. Of course. And that was, you know, that was just the time that I grew up in, you know, the 80s. I graduated from high school in 1986. So when I was in high school, that was, you know, the height of that music. And that was what I was drawn to. And it was, you know, I grew up in suburban Minnesota. So the life of Duran Duran and shooting videos in Sri Lanka and all that sort of very glamorous, exotic life was about as far as could be from what I live day to day. But that's the fun of it. And when you're a teenager, you might as well just indulge yourself in that. It makes things a lot more fun.
So is Christopher Penman the man of your dreams? Is he the fantasy character who you imagined as a teenager? Or does he get filled out as, and we'll talk more about your music career, but you found yourself in the music business. So you actually knew some of these characters, rock stars.
Christopher is very much an amalgamation of, you know, I started out with John Taylor from Duran Duran was sort of the starting point, but only really in terms of physical characteristics. And it gave me something to latch onto in terms of feelings. Like I could go back and think about the way that I felt about him when I was a teenager. But Christopher very much took on his own life and became a real person as I wrote the book. And so there are little bits of other rock stars that I've known personally sort of sprinkled in Christopher's personality, but he's very much his own person. He's not a cartoon.
Will you read for us?
Sure, absolutely. All right, I'm going to read. This is the beginning of chapter two, or near the beginning of chapter two. This is basically when Claire walks into the hotel lobby in New York and lays her eyes on Christopher in the flesh the first time. Okay. There he sat, no more than 10 feet away, reading the New York Times while wearing silvery sunglasses. I decided he must be napping because he didn't strike me as the type to read the Times. He wore an artfully distressed pair of jeans and a black t-shirt under a tan canvas jacket, much too light for such a cold day. His short, chestnut-brown hair was arranged into a tousled mess. I mulled over my best approach, and then he confounded me a second time by making eye contact, through the sunglasses no less, folding his paper and striding toward me. I looked behind me, assuming he must recognize someone else. "You must be Ms. Abby," he held out his hand. "Chris Penman." Countless thoughts and questions erupted in my head. Wow, I'm glad I wore heels. He's tall. His accent is different in person. It's like butter. British butter. Did I remember perfume this morning? Oh, crap, my breath. I should have had a piece of gum in the car. Are my hands clammy? Why do they always get that way when I'm nervous?
Karen Booth reading from her book, Bring Me Back. She's going to be at McIntyre's Books at Farrington Village on the 30th at 2 o'clock with me here today on The State of Things. So this is Claire and Christopher. They meet for the very first time. I mean, part of the problem for Claire is going to be she's got to write an article, you know.
Right, exactly. That's very much she has to, every weird little thought that's going through her head about how surreal this is, and they have a very surreal morning, that morning when they start the interview, she has to just forget all of that because she's on the clock. And this is a big thing for her. Her career has been very up and down. It's a huge opportunity. And he's also someone who he hasn't been interviewed in years. He hates the media. And so he's sort of left himself open to speculation. People talk about him. There are rumors, but he never owns up to anything. And it's her job to get his past basically out of him.
And so I like the idea that escape is really one of the themes in this book, and it's a romance.
Right.
So in a way, it's escape itself. So
right.
All that's happening in the book. Claire is someone who's got a lot to escape and in some ways and has this fantasy life, but she picks this career where your job is as a journalist, right, to render real these fantastic worlds.
Right.
Particularly the world of a rock star.
Right.
So she's really kind of whirling in a vortex to begin with.
She very much is. She very much is.
And it's steamy. This is a sexy book. You've got lots of words in here that I don't always read in literature.
It is steamy, though it's not 50 Shades of Grey. It's not, it doesn't, you know, go into that realm. And I tried to be very smart and, you know, I didn't use a lot of cutesy euphemisms and I also didn't use a lot of big girl words either. I tried to be as smart and clever about it as I possibly could.
When now, have your friends read this? Your husband has had to read this.
My husband's read it. The first time he read it, he said, "I can't believe how far you took the sex." That was the first thing he said to me.
Could you believe how far you took the sex?
I couldn't. This was the first book I wrote, even though it's the fourth book that's come out.
Wait a minute. You've four books have come out, but you've only written one of them?
No. I wrote all four of them, but this was the first one I wrote.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't. How did the other ones come out? Where did they come from?
Well, it's just this book, Bring Me Back, my publisher works on a much more traditional publishing schedule.
Yeah.
So even though it was one of the first contracts I signed, there's a long lead time there, especially when it's coming out in print.
Oh, I see. So this is the first book to be published.
Right, exactly.
But the others are sort of waiting in line.
Right. The first three books were e-books, and those can come out much quicker.
I get it.
But no, so this was the first book I wrote, and I didn't really know where I was going or what I was doing, to be perfectly honest. But that was the fun of it. I just went with it and just, you know, sort of followed my nose and wrote what made sense and where the characters wanted me to go.
You know, it's an interesting thing when you have all of these things that happen to us in our teenage years and the feelings and emotions that we have them, and then we move on. And we don't always go back and reflect on sort of how far we've changed and how far we've come. But when you write this book and have to recreate this character in a way, I wonder what it did when you sort of came face to face with your little teenage self, or did you?
I very much did, because I really had to tap into the way I felt when I was 16 years old, 17 years old, you know, in high school and just dealing with boys and all that kind of stuff, trying to find your way in the world. But, you know, I think that's a good place to go. I have a teenage daughter who's 14, so I do think about it probably more than the average person. But, you know, I think it's good reflection. I think I highly recommend it.
Now, has your 14-year-old daughter read this?
She has not read it. She's peeked at a few pages, but I told her I wasn't quite ready for her to read it yet.
I bet you $100 she has read it. And you just
you think
don't know.
So? You think so? She probably is stuck in my office. Full
just
copies,
saying.
Probably.
Right now,
it is sitting on my laptop.
Mom's
so,
in the state yeah. of things. I think I can just pull it up right here.
Right.
You did get in the music business and ended up at Mammoth Records mm-hmm. in Carrboro, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that. How did you do that? How did you get in the music business to begin with?
It was just one of those things. It was, you know, I was very preoccupied with music in high school. When I went to college at the University of Minnesota, I ended up at the college radio station, DJing and playing records. And someone from Twin Tone Records in Minneapolis called the office, the radio station office, and said they needed an intern. And I happened to answer the phone that day, and I said, sure, I'll do it. They had my most favorite band in the whole world at the time, which was Soul Asylum. And that was just one thing led to another. You know, I worked my butt off as an intern. I packed up boxes until I was blue in the face. And eventually they gave me a part-time job, which led to a full-time job. And then I met my husband through music, and he lived here. And so I ended up moving here after we realized the long-distance relationship wouldn't work. And then eventually I landed at Mammoth when there was, you know, there wasn't a whole bunch of music industry jobs in the Triangle.
Well, things have changed a lot. So
yes.
Tell us about Mammoth and kind of where the record industry was at that time and what it meant to work for a label when you started.
Right. Well, when I moved here in 1990, that was the year of Nirvana. And so everything changed that year. You know, all the hair metal bands fell to the side, sort of the late 80s stuff. All of a sudden, the big record companies wanted to scoop up the little record companies. They all wanted to find their Nirvana. So there were tons of baby bands all over the country getting money thrown at them and contracts and all that sort of thing. So it was exciting. And, you know, in Chapel Hill, you know, incredible music scene in a teeny tiny little town. And so I felt very lucky to be here and be just witness any of that, let alone sort of, you know, a lot of it.
So DIY is a big deal now. The kind of the big names and glamour is falling away. And everybody's looking for the next Seattle, right? What town is going to be the next Seattle?
Right. Well, and I don't know if there is such a thing anymore because, you know, because the playing field has been leveled so much, anybody can get Pro Tools and record a record and put it online and try to find their audience. You know, if they're persistent enough and they have good music, they might have some success with it. But, you know, the club scenes aren't really what they used to be. And so much of that was what fostered, you know, the Chapel Hill, the Seattle, the Minneapolis, Boston, you know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how that changed, because Mammoth Records, you talked about the big companies looking at the little ones. Disney fell in love with Mammoth.
Right, right.
Tell us that story.
That was interesting.
Yeah, I can.
It was good. Jay Ferris, who owned the company, you know, Mammoth had a lot of options. We had really great artists signed to the
label.
Yeah,
so give me a sense of who.
So 7 Mary 3, they had a huge hit with a song called "Cumbersome." That record went platinum, multi-platinum. The Squirrelnut Zippers from, you know, this little
from this area,
right? This area. That was, you know, another artist that went platinum, and Disney loved that. They loved that we had this sort of eclectic stable of music. Their whole thing is the cutting edge of family entertainment. I think for whatever reason, they thought that we represented that. So it was interesting. It was great. It was an exciting time to have them come in, and, you know, we hired a whole bunch of new people, and we all became cast members. You have to become a cast member.
Because you're working for the mouse.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You're working for the mouse. They even give you a name tag. Even if you're never going to step foot in a theme park with a name tag on, they give you a name tag.
That's great. So, but this is now a huge, huge entertainment corporation that may talk about being cutting-edge family entertainment, but it's
right.
about the money.
Oh, yeah, of course. And that ends up being, you know, anytime you try and make money from creativity, there's going to be problems. You know, artistic differences or whatever you want to call it. And sure, there were growing pains along the way, but I think that's, you know, that could be said about anything. You know, we wanted to retain our identity. We wanted to stay in Carrboro. They didn't totally understand that. I actually had someone from Disney once ask me if there were tumbleweeds rolling down the street in front of our office.
Yeah, because it'd be much better to be in Anaheim, California.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. But, you know, it was very cool and interesting to watch all of that happen. It didn't have the best ending because...
Well, tell us about the ending. Tell us a spoiler alert. This Disney film does not have a happy ending.
Right, exactly.
Well, maybe it does, but go ahead.
Well, I think it didn't work out. You know, they had, this was like late 90s, 98 by the time things, 98, 99 by the time things dissolved. And the economy was not great. And, they demanded more and more from us. We wanted to retain our identity, continue to sign whoever we wanted to sign. And they wanted more involvement and we wanted them to have less. And it just didn't work out.
Well, did they? I mean, are they still doing, are they in the record business still?
Mammoth?
Not Mammoth, Disney.
Disney, well, they still have Hollywood Records. And, they always have some sort of music thing tied in with their films.
Because you sort of wonder if they had some idea that this DIY thing is something they could get into. But it's a corporation, and you kind of wonder if they just were in the wrong field, that they couldn't really make those two cultures come together.
Right. And I think part of it is just, well, everyone else is doing it, so we have to do this too.
Right.
Because, otherwise we look like idiots.
But out they go. But it seems to me that that story sheds light on the bigger story that you were talking about earlier. The record industry has changed. The role of labels is unclear. Anybody with a laptop can now put out their music. So the good news is more good bands get out, fewer gatekeepers, right?
True.
Bad news is how do we find them? And there's obviously a lot of trash in the air, but there always was. I mean,
right.
You just had gatekeepers that kept you from some good stuff, maybe.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, I'm a firm believer that when there's good music out there, people will find it. But it's all about the persistence of the artist. You know, do they have the means? Do they have the time? Are they able to devote to writing music and recording and touring or, playing shows or whatever. It's a lot of hard work. And a lot of times all that hard work amounts to, very little. Mm-hmm. But I always believe that, really good stuff just finds a way to float to the top. It only takes one person to go see a band or read a book or see a movie or whatever and say, oh my God, this is so amazing. And then they tell 20 friends and that's how.
And because there aren't a couple of record companies telling us what's great and really, promoting one artist over another and dropping an artist when, because they used to, and I don't know if they still do this, but they used to backload those contracts. So we wouldn't pay you much up front. You'd have a hit. We'd put a lot behind you. And the minute you got to record two where it'd get expensive, we'd drop you and find somebody else.
Right, right.
There's a whole lot of that. So without bands having to imitate those top performers who were there primarily because of promotion, that allows them to really, pursue their own creativity and not have to imitate the 7 or 8 or 9 bands in the top 40.
Right, exactly. And they have much more control over everything that they do, the packaging, the way that they image themselves, whether it's their website or CD packaging. There's no battle with, it's usually just bands doing it themselves. So there's not the battle with the record label to...
So you know you some recording business.
I do.
You have
I
the
do.
Authority to write Bring Me Back, a wonderful book, a romance. Karen Booth, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Karen Booth is the author of Bring Me Back. She's going to be at McIntyre's Books in Farrington Village on the 30th of this month at 2 o'clock. And for more information, you can go to our website, wunc.org. Next, we find out the fate of North Carolina's Red Wolf population. Stay tuned.